Welcome back to part two of today's podcast with the UK's Suella Braverman.
To a lesser degree and some to a greater degree, where multiculturalism has distorted our sense of justice and what is right or wrong in this country. And that's because there are lots of people who are coming into this country, not everybody, but there are many people who are coming into this country who are not signing up to British values, who are not signing up to the values that define Western civilization, which have made Britain great in the past. So, you know, the common law, respect for democracy, the treatment of women, respectful treatment of women, because that's what this comes down to. It comes down to an outdated, frankly, medieval view of women that some cultures possess, and they've transplanted those attitudes here in the UK, in a Western country, and it's led to an injustice. Sharia law. There are some parts of our country where Sharia law effectively applies. There are some parts of our country where ghettos have sprung up and people don't speak English. So we're creating an atomized society if we're not careful. And, we are losing a sense. That's what really worries me. We're losing a sense of a common creed, a common and unifying vision of what it is to be British. And we're losing that pride in our country.
Right. I mean, this is such a horrendous, shocking scandal to even read about this. But it's the most extreme example of the idea of patriotism being somehow viewed as racist and exclusionary to the point where really basic decency has been destroyed. And, you know, we're reading here about this scandal in Britain, really what amounts to a cover-up. I don't know how to describe it otherwise. And I'm wondering where this is going now, because from my reading, there's been a decision to not allow a complete investigation of this. Is that the end of the story, or what do you think will happen now at this point?
Well, the government has refused to conduct a national inquiry. And that would mean that an independent expert would be paid to look into this issue and identify and ascertain who did what and when and how, and learn some lessons and make some policy recommendations to the government on how to fix it. And the government has refused a big national inquiry into this issue. We had a vote on it last week. There have been other inquiries and reports into this issue. Unfortunately, this has been going on for, as I said, a decade. So there have been reports and, you know, at various episodes, it kind of, the issue grabs the nation's attention and then it does seem to ebb away again. When I was Home Secretary, I tried to work on this issue. Prime Minister was actually very supportive of me on this matter. We set up a specialist task force with the police. We made 500 arrests in the first year. We identified 4,000 victims who were safeguarded from subsequent harm. So we achieved some progress, but you know, much more needs to be done. Ultimately, what really needs to be overhauled is what the police are doing. And are the police diverting sufficient specialist resource to these investigations? Are the investigations being progressed in a timely or expedited way? Many investigations take, particularly when it comes to child sexual exploitation, they do take sometimes years to compile the cases. But we need to, if we really are serious about securing justice for these victims, making an example of the perpetrators. I mean, there have been some trials and convictions and hefty sentences in the past, but there's still many, this scandal is still going on. It's actually still ongoing. Right. But if we're to bring an end to it, we need to show that the justice system will come down really heavily on the people who are perpetrating it. And at the moment, I don't think it is. So it needs operational change. We need to change the law, and the government needs to be much more forthcoming with backing the victims. I mean, to reflect the problem, you know, again, just last week, the Prime Minister, when asked about an inquiry, he said it was people are jumping on a far right bandwagon. by calling for an inquiry. Yeah. It's just that kind of demonization that the left always tries to adopt to silence those of us on the right who are speaking up for justice and truth. They did it during the presidential election. I lost count of the number of times that the Democrats were smearing Donald Trump as being a far-right Nazi and comparing his rallies to Nuremberg rallies. And absolutely, it didn't work. It doesn't work. But the left haven't quite got that memo, but it doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, it's not so quick to not work, though. I mean, I think it does require people. As you know, it's a complicated issue. And this sort of brings me into the related issue to the inquiry that you're talking about that may or may not happen. And that is the broader issue of free speech, of dissent, of the media. And we are very frightened, or at least I will speak for myself, about what's happened in the UK with this idea that punishment, jail or criminal punishment for writing something on social media is now in play. I mean, we are a country here in the U.S. that, you know, one of the fundamental freedoms is freedom of speech. It's codified in the Constitution. On the other hand, we've had freedom of speech threatened, you know, with a lot of cancel culture, censorship, whatever you want to call it. It's all sort of part of the same thing. Demonization was the term that you used. What is going on now in the UK? Is there any kind of what is there a big pushback against this use of the law to stop people from simply voicing opinion?
I would say that free speech is in crisis in the United Kingdom today. And that's a tragedy, given that the freedom of speech, our free press, freedom of thought, freedom of religion have been cornerstones of, Western civilization, cultivated in Britain in centuries past. So, yeah, I would say it's in crisis. We have countless examples of where people, personalities, politicians, I mean, myself, I've been on the receiving end of it, who've been cancelled by institutions, by attempts by the police, by the media, by the left-wing establishment generally, for expressing what I would say are, in many cases, legitimately held views, but they don't align with, the left-wing prevailing narrative. So, we've got a situation here in the UK where the police, as you rightly point out, can knock on your door if you tweeted out, a man cannot be a woman. We've had some cases which have gone to court on that basis, and someone expressing gender critical views. I'd say correct, but biologically correct views can be not quite go to prison. We haven't had anyone incarcerated for it, but they can get a visit from a police officer, and they can have their personal details recorded, and they can be logged as having committed what we call a non-crime hate incident. So it's not quite a crime, but it's something that offended someone out there. And it's sufficiently serious enough to justify using vital police resource on. So that we've had a lot of instances of about that, where police powers have been used in a draconian way to snuff out freedom of speech. We've got the situation where, I was cancelled earlier last year when I was going to speak at Cambridge University. Politicians are invited to speak in all sorts of places. And I've been very vocal in my support for Israel. And on the day of the event that I was going to speak, and there was going to be an audience of students, the police called me up and they said, Reverend, I don't think you should go ahead with this event because we can't guarantee your security. And I said, what are you talking about? And they said, well, there's a pro-Palestinian group that is organizing to picket outside your event, and we don't think we think there might be a risk of violence, and it could get a bit messy, and we just don't think you should go ahead with it, and we can't implement any extra security measures, so you should cancel your event. And so the event was cancelled, and I was cancelled because the mob, the bullying mob, was able to assert their views over the law-abiding majority. We did eventually reschedule the event and it went ahead. But that's another example. So if you know, if you express support for Israel on campus and something you've been dealing with in America, you know, you will you'll get a really difficult time. And anti-Semitism
it's one thing to meet
and takes a lot of courage to defend Israel publicly in the United Kingdom.
Yes. And now it's one thing to be having to deal with protesters, but it's another when the police says they will not protect you, you're in danger and they're not going to do anything about it. And I wonder, is it a popular opinion in the UK, if you could even assess it? Does the public support this kind of breakdown of free speech? Does the public even realize that no one should be in charge of policing what's correct speech and what's allowed speech? I mean, this is 1984 was an understatement for this kind of thing. I mean, I wonder what the popular opinion is in the UK on this.
Well, I think majority opinion is very anxious about this Orwellian Big Brother state that we are increasingly living in the UK. And, you know, I've lost count of the number of people who've told me, you know, under their breath, you know, Suella, you know, I agree with what you said, or I can't speak about this issue at work because I'll lose my job, or, you know, I can't say this publicly because, you know, it's gonna expose me. You know, we've now got to the stage where people self-censure and they don't express themselves freely. And we're talking about very, as I said, legitimate views. These are not, they're not inciting hatred. They're not speaking about violence. They're talking about, you know, as I said, that a man can't be a woman. They're trying to stand up for, you know, against pro-Palestinian extremism. They want to talk about the systematic rape of white girls by British Pakistani men. You know, these are just a sample of some of the issues that people feel very scared to talk about in the UK because of the consequences. So I think opinion, if they were speaking candidly and felt safe to express it, they would be on our side.
Yeah, I mean, I'm much more on the camp of I don't care if it's correct or not correct. I don't care if it's acceptable or not acceptable to say your opinion. It must be allowed to be said. Otherwise, you're really not a free society. You're not a free country. There is nothing more essential than the ability to speak against power, against public opinion, whether it's even if you're N equal one. So I'm very concerned with it. I would much rather err on the side of freedom and free speech than anything else. Otherwise, really nothing else is left after that. And I think, you know, we all grew up in the U.S. reading the books by George Orwell and others, and these are all British authors. So to see this kind of thing happening is really shocking to people like me anyway, who have watched this. I'd like to move on a little bit to sort of the international side of, you know, the U.S.-U.K., the special relationship. I think, you know, it's sort of interesting to me now in the post-Brexit world that the UK is even more unique in its relationship with the United States, I feel. It's a very separate issue now from Europe that we think of in the US. And I wonder how things are now because there's a lot of anxiety, as I sense, in the outside the U.S. about President Trump, about his talk about so-called Make America First. And I think I've told you in the past, but one time I was in Paris and an Uber driver was driving me, asked me what I did, and he pulled over the car when I told him, and he shook my hand and he said, "I wish we had a president in France that said, make France great again." Because I think, of course, every country should be concerned with their country. I mean, I don't even know why this is a controversial statement to make, But there is this anxiety, the way President Trump talks about the role of NATO. And of course, I believe, as probably many people would say, that this is it's a negotiation and there is a fairness issue in what people pay for their own security, et cetera. I wonder how the Trump election or how you perceive it is playing in the eyes of Britain, not just in the politicians' eyes, but in the citizens there, and how important a strong United States is to the rest of the free world and to our allies.
Well, I mean, I think I'm one of the first UK politicians who came out supporting Donald Trump, obviously Nigel Farage. I saw early on that a strong America means a safer world. And unfortunately, under Biden, America has been weak on the world stage. And, you know, I believe that, had Donald Trump been president over the last 4 years, we wouldn't have had October the 7th. I believe that. I don't believe we would have had the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And I don't believe Chinese aggression would be escalating in the way that it is. I believe Iran ultimately would have been, the threat from Iran would have been hugely mitigated, if not eliminated. So, I think the world would have been a safer place. So I'm very relieved that Donald Trump is now in the White House and or will be next week. And, I think it symbolizes an era of greater global security. We really need it right now because we are facing a real volatility when it comes to our geopolitics. We've got a combination of very well-resourced, sophisticated, and coordinated hostile states working together. The combination of Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea is a very, very serious one. And I think there's been complacency amongst NATO members to arm themselves sufficiently, invest in their defense, to be ready to defend ourselves against these enemies. And America, through its galvanizing effect on NATO members to invest more in defense through its robust and uncompromising approach to global security. For example, with taking a robust approach to Hamas and a similar approach to Iran, China and Russia, those two things, I think, really combined will mean that we will have a safer world. And, that is, I think it's easy to take peace for granted, but it's a strong America means more peace in the world. I went to Israel last year after October the 7th, and I met with Israeli members of the Israeli government and Israeli families, victims, survivors, and Israel's on the front line of extremism, Iranian aggression, and terrorism. And they're in fight for Western values, Western civilization, and Trump's unequivocal support for Israel. His hard approach to Hamas and the release of the hostages is hopefully going to bear fruit and, will bring an end to this tragic episode relating to Hamas. But, more globally, the way I see it is where there's a real battle going on between, on the one hand, these hostile states, which represent authoritarianism and totalitarianism, and on the other hand, democracies. And
right.
I'm not quite sure which side is going to win right now, but now that we've got Donald Trump in the White House, I think we've got a greater chance on our side.
Mm-hmm. Do you anticipate that there will be an opportunity or even a discussion of more formalized sort of Anglo alliances around the world? This has been talked about a little bit in the past. I wonder about that because, of course, Donald Trump, he has some ties to certainly Gulf in your part of the world, and he has a soft spot, I think, and I think every president understands the importance of the UK. I think there's an opportunity for new alliances. Everything is shifting, and I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I would love to say that this heralds a new chapter for Anglo-American relations and more collaboration. I mean, we already, you know, work very closely together on our intelligence and security and military work. But, you know, a free trade agreement would be brilliant and between the UK and the US. But, you know, I also think, but I am a bit pessimistic given who our prime minister is. I just think that this government has not got off to the best start with the incoming president. I'm afraid, you know, our foreign secretary, has put on record that he thinks, you know, he's been very rude about Donald Trump in the past.
Extremely. It's amazing, really, how these politicians were so short-sighted,
right.
I feel.
Right, idiotic.
Digging a hole.
Idiotic.
Yeah. Digging a hole where they anticipated that, you know, there was no way that President Trump would win. And now they come begging.
Exactly.
It's sort of pathetic.
Exactly. It is pathetic.
To see what's happening. But, you know, it also gives, you know, it gives somebody like Donald Trump, of course, such the upper hand.
Yes.
Because he understands negotiation.
Yeah.
He understands winners and losers in business deals. And I think they've really harmed, you know, they've harmed the United Kingdom in a funny way. Although, we'll see what happens.
I think that's absolutely right. So they've been rude and made ad hominem and ridiculous attacks on the incoming president. They sent over activists to campaign against him in the presidential election.
Right.
Again, short-sighted and misguided. You know, and they are on the verge of signing humiliating surrender deal with Mauritius over the Chagos Islands. So this issue has been rumbling on for a while, where we've got some British sovereign territory in the Indian Ocean in the form of the Chagos Islands, a kind of relic of the British Empire. And one of the islands is Diego Garcia, and the US uses it as a base. So it has strategic defense value for the UK and the US, particularly as a bulwark against increasing Chinese naval presence in the region, in the Indian Ocean. Now, the UK, this Labour government has jumped on a I can't describe it any other way other than a woke bandwagon, because they feel guilty about the British Empire and they believe in reparations and apologizing for our history. They are agreeing to give the Chagos Islands to Mauritius. And, in what would be a massive surrender of strategically important islands, not just for us, but for the US. So we are Marco Rubio has already said that the deal is not a good one and shouldn't be proceeded with. That's not stopped the Labour government from rushing around and go begging to the Mauritian government to try and secure a deal before the inauguration. There's a mad rush at the moment in the UK, and all the journalists are scurrying around trying to keep up with the developments, but they are trying to rush this deal through before the inauguration. Can you believe it? I mean, it's just pathetic. Because they know that Trump isn't keen on it. They think that if they can seal the deal before the inauguration, you know, they'll have it over the line. It's a bad deal politically. Economically, it doesn't make any sense at this time when we're teetering on the verge of a recession in the UK. And strategically, it's letting down one of our allies. And it's just playing into China's hands, because what's going to happen? We give these islands back to Mauritius, and in no time at all, the Chinese will have a base on one of these islands nearby, and will increase their presence at just the time when we should be eyeing China anywhere near the region. So it's bad on all levels. Governments trying to rush it through before inauguration. They are looking more and more desperate and, you know, irresponsible. I think, you know, Donald Trump, regardless if they sign anything in the next few days, Donald Trump can just could kill it off very quickly with the influence that he has. And I very much hope that he does kill off what is possibly becoming one of the worst deals in the history of our foreign policy.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of striking how these great countries, the United Kingdom, the United States, there's such a cohort inside of guilt, somehow apologizing for all of the great things that these countries have done. Not that they've been perfect, not that they haven't done very bad things along the way. But this idea that policies are somehow based on guilt, it's really sad to see. And a complete, to me, one of the reasons why President Trump won with this idea that, you know, the country, the U.S., but also the U.K., these are great countries with a tremendous amount of positive history, creating opportunity for people in freedom. And it's somehow been totally distorted by what we will call the woke, the leftist move. And I think your country has not repudiated it yet, but it seems like the time is coming.
I hope so. I hope so. Maybe that, you know, like in America, in a way, the left overreached. They went really, they went crazy with all the trans stuff and the race stuff and the, you know, the eco stuff. And it really, they lost mainstream opinion, and that's when, you know, the right was allowed to come back in. And I think, you know, we're very much in that territory in the UK. And listen, let me just say, well, you know, I'm a product of the British Empire. My parents were born under the empire.
Right.
My mother was born in Mauritius in the 1940s.
Mauritius,
and my dad was
right.
born in Kenya at a similar time. And they came over to Britain in the 1960s when their countries got independence. They've got nothing but admiration and gratitude for the British Empire. They don't see it as a racist project. They don't see it as something whereby they were enslaved or exploited. Quite the contrary. Those countries, Kenya, Mauritius, India, you know, they were made thanks to the British Empire. Huge amounts of investment went into those countries to build railways and infrastructure and irrigation and drainage and ports and the legal system and the education system, you know, and the foundations of modern India, modern Kenya, modern Mauritius, you know, were laid by the British Empire. So you're right, there was a positive history, but all we hear about by this government, from this government, and in our kind of prevailing narrative in our school books, I'm afraid as well in this country, is how bad the British history has been and how many apologies we have to make, such that even members of our own royal family and are talking about apologies and reparations. You know, it's very, very sad.
Right.
A great country like the UK.
It's very sad. And on the other hand, we can be optimistic that the American people woke up, and now we're going to wait for the Brits to follow suit. So I could go on forever with you. I hope they have you back. But I really want to thank you, Suella, for taking the time to squeeze us in between the bell ringing for the
no
boats
bells.
Out there.
We're not for court web bells. No, it's a real pleasure. And Scott, please keep going with your pioneering and incredibly valuable work. We need voices of common sense, inspiring the leaders of the future, and really cultivating a coherent policy platform for you know, many of us who are working in government. So thank you for everything you're doing.
I appreciate that very much, and looking forward to seeing you again soon.
Likewise.
Thank you for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, the Right Honorable Suella Braverman, Member of Parliament of the United Kingdom, watch for her interviews and her newsmaking work on behalf of the British people. And don't forget, subscribe to this show on YouTube, as well as Spotify, Apple, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now. And I'll see you next time.